We're doomed, we're saved.
The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts, Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. We're doomed, we're saved. Episode number 29. Today, the science of stress, a cortisol conspiracy. Welcome, Easy.
Welcome, good morning.
As we're closing in on the holiday season while recording this episode, it might be a good idea to address the issue because, while we least expect it during the holidays, stress is a very present thing exactly at this time of the year for many of us. But, of course, we'll be looking at the phenomenon of stress at a wider general perspective. As always, we start with quotes. What did you bring?
Yeah, I brought a quote from Hans Selye, who is kind of the founding father of the field of stress research from the beginning of the 20th century. And what he says, it's not the stress that kills us, it is our reaction to it. And I think that's a nice summary of what we're going to discuss today. And I also brought a quote from someone that I actually didn't expect to quote in this podcast, but I'm doing it anyways. And I listened to a full episode of his very popular podcast, Andrew Huberman. He says, stress is not always bad. In fact, a certain amount of stress can be beneficial for growth and learning.
Huberman, not exactly popular in the science community, I understand.
He's a little bit debated. I think from the scientific side, I'm not a fan of this kind of podcast, I have to say. But since he talks a lot about stress, I listened to an episode. And I think, like, scientifically, I found it very solid. So there is no complaints about that. I think it's more a little bit this bio bro mentality behind it that I find a little bit questionable, and maybe some other people do as well. But maybe we get into that during the episode.
So even from the quotes, we learn stress in itself is not always bad, quite the contrary. One could go so far to say it did help time and again our species to survive stress factors. But we all know that the stress factors that surround us are many, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's not only the amount of stress that counts, but also, as both of these quotes already implement, it's our framing of the stress, because it's not only evolutionary relevant. So we have this idea that only during the long gone times of our species, when we were chased by wild animals through the forest or through the savanna, which probably also didn't happen as much as one might think, that only then stress was a relevant cue, and that it's kind of like an appendix, you know, like an organ that we don't need or a mechanism that we don't need anymore. But that's not true. We still need stress in a positive sense because it's what makes us alert. It's also a system that is very tightly linked to our circadian rhythm, which, for example, gets us to get up in the morning. So if we would completely reduce the stress system, we would be very, like, basically catatonic probably. And I think all of us know these positive stress situations, for example. I mean, both of us, right, we speak in front of a lot of people during events. It's very stressful, but you need this rush of stress hormones to actually get going and get on stage and do it. And if you have none of that, I think we would not be able to do these positive things. So stress per se is not a negative thing, and it can actually be, and I think that really goes back also to Selye, pretty long time ago, be classified into eustress, positive stress, and distress, stress that makes us feel bad. And stressors that persist, as you say, over a long time can make us feel bad and then can also have quite negative effects on our minds and bodies.
So we're pretty much away from the fight and flight that our forefathers had, you know, as an instinct, or maybe it is an instinct, to something that is the eustress. I like the term very much. I mean, we've been talking about that. I've been teaching this also when I do consulting for stage presence or something. The moment you are not excited anymore, / you don't feel any stress anymore when you go onto a stage, it's not exactly good.
No, it isn't. It isn't. And I think it's something that many people who have presented for a long time will know, that you have this moment of slack maybe where you feel like, yeah, I got this. And then you realize if you're too certain, it actually doesn't go as well as if you're a little bit stressed before. But I think what you mentioned, so the fight or flight response, we still have that. This is not something that is only an evolutionary mechanism. It's a persisting mechanism. We still have this rush of adrenaline and epinephrine that is triggered by the sympathetic nervous system or to the sympathetic nervous system. And that then brings our muscles to contract and brings the blood flow to the middle of the body and to the brain. So maybe some of you will know if you're very stressed that the hand and feet can get cold or can even get numb.
Absolutely.
Or you feel like your eyes are popping. So your pupils are dilating. You feel this maybe like rush of blood in your ears. All of that is fight or flight response. This is a still persisting mechanism which becomes kind of maladaptive in our modern world. So many of us people living in the Western world don't experience this existential stressors anymore. So we have an unpleasant meeting. We need to write an email. For me, the worst stressor of all is to have to make a phone call. It stresses me no end. Yeah. So this can also cause these mechanisms of fight or flight response, which of course is quite maladaptive because being so stressed about something that's so meaningless, like writing an email, just leaves you with all these stress hormones and all this like readiness to act in your body, but you don't do anything, right? You just keep sitting at your desk and nothing happens. And part, I think, of what we perceive as this accumulating stress is really this non-action that follows our severe response to stress. So we are ready to run, or maybe we're also ready to freeze. So it's fight, flight, or freeze response, but we're ready to do something. Yeah. So our muscles are tense, our blood is rushing. We want to get going, get acting, and then we do absolutely nothing. And in the next 10 minutes, the next stressor comes. It's kind of a no-brainer that this can become quite severe. I just also want to, and I think there's very little research on that, but I think this idea that people in previous times were not as stressed, I find that a little bit hard to believe because I think the living conditions of people even 200 years ago had many more existential threats and stresses, right? So you had to fear for your actual livelihood, for your survival, for the survival of your family much more often than a person living in the Western world, let's say, in peaceful conditions today. And I think these existential stressors, I mean, they also interact with the stress response. And next to that, it's not only perceived threats, but it's also actual bodily threats that we don't even realize that can increase the stress system. For example, if you have an infection, if you have a hemorrhage, if you have a heart attack, I mean, this also induces your stress system, but it's not something that you consciously, you know, like get to your mind, I'm getting stressed by something here. So I think the stress response probably was activated throughout the history of humankind and is still very active today. It's just the types of stressors are changing and the way that we react to the stressors is changing. Again, something that I think we find back in these quotes in the beginning. So it's a bit this cognitive component of stress that has changed.
So before we come to the role of a certain particular hormone, what do we know about current stressors? You mentioned and made the distinction of the Western world versus the rest of the world, where we would have more existential threats still. In the Western world, that is stressed by, let's say, the digital world. So how much do we know now? Has there been research on that? What does a TikTok all day do to me and my stress situation?
It's, of course, always a little bit hard to quantify stress, but surveys show that in countries like Germany, the United States, or France, 60 to 80% of people say that they suffer from chronic stress. And a significant amount of people also suffers from stress-related diseases, for example, like anxiety disorders. I think 30% of Americans will have an anxiety disorder somewhere during their lifetime. This is very strongly related to stress. Actually, also panic attacks are fight or flight responses on steroids, basically. So we'll talk a bit about steroids. So this was just a saying here, but the steroids anyways come into play here. But I think it's really very evident, and I think it's also anecdotal and something that we know from ourselves and we know from speaking to other people, modern humans are very stressed, and they are stressed by many of the stressors of modern life, which is being constantly reachable. Yeah, so you cannot shut down. You have your cell phone, which probably has your work email and your Teams and Slack and whatever, and you always see this blinking symbols and potentially even have like a little sound that stresses you out. I mean, there's this popular thing on Instagram or TikTok where people say which is the song that instantly makes you cry, and then you have the melody of Teams like yeah, but it's really, and I notice myself that these triggers, yeah, this sounds of, for example, like an incoming call or this blinking symbol of you got a new message can induce stress. And it's something that's very noticeable. Another thing is that the light of the screen is not very healthy for us. We don't go outside as much as we used to, and we get into like the role of the circadian rhythm in a bit, because we're actually quite tightly linked to light and dark cycles. So sitting in the dark all day and night is not super beneficial. And then there is also this element of just shifting our balance of when we rest and how much we rest towards that we combine activities a lot. So we eat in front of the computer, for example, or we work while traveling, or we turn like private occasions into work occasions and the other way around. So there's just the modern lifestyle has a lot of stress-inducing factors. That said, there are many other stress-inducing factors, again, which I think have been there throughout the history of humankind, which is just living together with other people, which is very stressful because you have a lot of interpersonal conflicts in any kind of relationship. I mean, this is unavoidable. And therefore, I think that also ancient humans were not only stressed by this always like quoted lion that chases you, they were probably also very stressed by the five other people that they were living with and had to deal with on a daily basis.
And potentially wanted to kill them. Maybe, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, or it's really just, I mean, go on holiday with five friends, live together with a family, go together with five co-workers, and you will have conflict. And I think it's just normal, but this is also an inducer of stress responses. The other part is, of course, again, these existential threats are, of course, not only hunger, war, or others. These are also, for example, violent relationships with partners or in the family, abusive situations, very toxic situations, living with people who have mental disorders. All of that can be massive stressors. These are things I think that not only modern humans have, but what we have on top is this overload of information, this overload of social media, of all these things that adds to the stress. And I think that also brings parts of this interpersonal conflict, unfortunately, into the digital realm. So it persists like constantly. So we cannot get rid of
like it. A merry-go-round in a way. Yes, mm-hmm, absolutely.
Exactly.
Izzy, we call this episode A Cortisol Conspiracy. It's a wonderful thriller title, by the way. We got to get a little closer to cortisol and what it does.
Yeah. So what we've discussed so far mainly is one axis of the stress response, which is this initial fast response, the fight or flight response. Yeah. So you have a threat and you're immediately like tense and okay, something's got to happen. But you also have a slightly slower response, which is initiated by the so-called hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is a series of glands in the brain. And then in the cortex of the adrenal glands, they're little glands that sit on top of your kidneys, and they lead to the release of the so-called stress hormone cortisol. Cortisol is a glucocorticoid, and this goes throughout the body, throughout the bloodstream, and then activates and inhibits a number of responses. So both of these responses, fight or flight, and then the HPA response, I'd say HPA, this is the abbreviation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is a little bit of a mouthful. So HPA is a thankful abbreviation for that. So both of them act in concert, and cortisol is a bit more like integrating this response, this little bit slower response that then, for example, also leads to the mobilization of glucose. So you want to keep feeding your muscles and want to keep feeding your brain. It regulates gene expression on multiple levels, and it regulates also the function of inflammation and of the immune system. So it basically down-regulates a lot of function that you don't need in this active response to stress. So while you are being stressed, you want to function, you want to be able to deal with the stressor, and all of the other stuff that you might take care of, like digestion, like immune system responses, like reproduction, all of these things, you can do them later, right? First, you want to survive and then do all the rest later on. And cortisol is important for that. Cortisol is extremely complex. So in preparation for this episode, I read a couple of articles and I said, like, constantly the feeling, somehow this says something different than the other one. So the problem is, and here is where it gets really complicated. Generally, hormone release systems are pretty complicated because they are buffered in a complex way. This is also true for the cortisol system. So it regulates itself. So it has a negative feedback loop. So if you have a lot of cortisol, then it signals back to this HPA axis, to the glands that come before in your brain, that and tell it, like, okay, enough, don't make more. We're already dealing with the stress now. So this is one part. So having a lot of something can also lead to the down regulation of it. The other part of it is that this is actually in a pulsatory pattern. So it is released in waves. So you have a little bit higher and a little bit lower levels in general throughout the day. But then something else happens on top because it's very tightly linked. I said that before, to the circadian rhythms. So you have the highest amount of cortisol early in the morning. This is actually what gets you out of bed. So if you would get rid of this system, it would, for example, be really hard to get out of bed because this is our signal. So somehow we know, right, it's time to get up for many of us. I usually wake up without an alarm, like close to the time when my alarm would go off. And I think this is true for many people. And this is the cortisol.
And this is high and healthy cortisol at that time of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Then.
Exactly. Okay. This is just the normal response.
No need to worry.
But not at all, no. What could make you worry a little bit, because the cortisol levels should be very low during the night. So if you are someone like me who, if you're very stressed, wakes up at 3 and has a hard time going back to sleep, this is also cortisol, which spikes at the wrong time. So if you're very stressed, you have higher levels of cortisol often, and this can lead to sleep disturbances because it spikes at times where it shouldn't. And then throughout the day, cortisol goes lower, lower, lower. It has a little bit of a spike in the afternoon, which I think also relates to this after lunch dip, many of us, and then you have a little bit more energy again, like towards late afternoon, evening. Again, this is closely linked to cortisol function. And all of these patterns, so this link to the circadian rhythm, this pulsatile pattern throughout, this is on top of the circadian rhythm. So you have like a big wave and then a lot of small waves going on top of that. And then you have negative feedback loops and you have a lot of different systems that integrate this cortisol signal. So just saying how much cortisol do I have is already a super difficult question. And the amount of cortisol that you have at the level or at the moment where the stress arises will also change the way that this stress is being integrated. So you could react differently depending on the time of day, depending also on your already on the height of your levels in general. And this makes it a little bit hard to predict what will happen. Constant or chronic stress seems to lead in many people to higher cortisol levels. And this is related to a number of negative outcomes. One of them is that the initial downregulation of inflammation can actually turn around and lead to constant low-level inflammation, para-inflammation, which is related to some autoimmune diseases potentially, or a higher risk of allergies. A lower level or a downregulation of the immune system and a shift in, so it doesn't downregulate the whole immune system, but certain parts of the immune system. And this will lead you to higher chances of getting infections. This regulation of the metabolic axis can lead to insulin resistance, can lead to diabetes, can lead to weight gain. There are effects on increased fat tissue production, on actually muscle decrease, even osteoporosis, bone decrease. So there are many negative functions also on the brain. So it seems to be related to many disorders, depression, anxiety disorder, but also as part of PTSD seems to play a role. So in all of these systems, cortisol levels seem to be part of regulating negative responses. The thing is that, and this is something that I found very hard to understand, it seems to be not only constantly increased cortisol levels, but for some people, and the effects are relatively similar, you can also have then decreased cortisol levels, which come based on this negative feedback loop. So when you have like a persistent stress response with high levels of the stress hormone, at some point it seems to go down. And then again, you get similar negative effects. You get like, you feel tired, you feel depressed, sleep disturbance, all these things again happen. So I think in general, what we can say that a dysregulation of the cortisol system for a long time can have negative health outcomes. What we need to be aware of that it's not only cortisol. There are other hormones and other functions that play a role.
So if there are profits in the net, social media influencers claiming keep your cortisol in check and you'll be good stress-wise, it's a lie, full stop?
No. So I think keeping the cortisol in check is a very good idea. The problem is, how do you do that? Because and this is where it gets so complicated. It used to be, I think from last year on, a trend on TikTok. I'm not on TikTok, but I get that like secondhand, like the regular old person on Instagram, where people started to talk about a condition called cortisol face. So having a little bit puffy, rounder face, which would be related to increased cortisol levels. And then all negative things that happened in people's lives were related to cortisol, so having problems losing weight, especially in the abdominal area, having this increased levels of inflammation, having high blood pressure, feeling tired, feeling depressed, all of that. And I mean, based on my previous sermon, all of these things can also be linked to cortisol. The thing is that what people describing their cortisol phase is a very rare condition, which is called Cushing's or Cushing's syndrome. It's a disease that comes from really high cortisol levels, for example, by tumors in the adrenal system, for example, in the pituitary gland or in the adrenal cortex. Then this can happen. It's also something that can happen if you are treated constantly with exogenous corticosteroids. This is something for many immune diseases or for cancer, people get steroids. So also there you can get this symptom of having inflammation in the face that leads to, and having a water retention that leads to this puffy phenotype. And then you also get a number of other partly pretty severe things. So muscles can decay, osteoporosis can happen, you get like easy bruising under the skin gets thinner, all of these things. But what the people on TikTok are describing is usually, first of all, they look completely normal. They don't look like they have this phenotype. And diagnosing yourself with a very severe disease and telling everyone else that you have that is, in my opinion, not such a good idea. And despite the fact that we are very stressed and we might also have cortisol dysregulation at parts in our life, does not mean that we suffer from this constant hypercortisolism, or also the opposite, what I just said, the hypocortisolism. So when it goes down very strongly, based on what doctors say, this is in most cases not true. And what people are perceiving, so they have trouble sleeping, they have trouble losing weight, they feel generally anxious. This is all part of stress, and cortisol will play a role, but there are many other factors that play a role. And I'm not saying that not keeping an eye on what leads to higher cortisol is not a good idea. The problem is that cortisol itself, in most cases, it will not help us, right? Because what we need to do is to regulate the stress. This is all we can do. And then having this very simple answer, and also putting, in my opinion, an additional layer of stress onto people that then look in the mirror and think, do I have cortisol face? Stress is a super complex problem. And I think I tried to explain parts of it, but I also have to say that I'm also when I was reading up on it for parts, I was really reaching the edge of what I could understand or make sense of, because it's really so strongly dependent on so many different systems. I mean, it relates to different parts of the brain, for example, the amygdala, which is part of our fear center, emotional center. So depending also how you integrate stressors, if you are generally fearful and anxious, or if you're generally optimistic and hopeful person, will change the way that you perceive stress. So what I'm trying to say is that there is not that simple answer. And I think what TikTok, and to an extent, although I think he still puts it into different perspective, but people like Andrew Huberman would make you believe, is that there are simple answers. And I also have to say there are some simple answers. And this is also part of what these cortisol detoxes, and what also the schedules of Andrew Huberman. I mean, exercising, sleeping, and eating healthy is a very, very good idea for regulating your cortisol and for all other things in your life, right? I mean, it's very obvious that this is a good idea. We talked about it in many episodes when we talk about longevity, when we talk about obesity, all these things. It's kind of obvious, right? Move, eat healthy, sleep. But I think the problem is that our modern lifestyles are very desynchronized from that. And then adding this additional stressor of having complex regimen where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to, okay, you anyways get up very early, but for other people that like to sleep till seven, like me, it does not help me to get up an hour early, to get like a half an hour of direct sunlight, half an hour of meditation, three different supplements. And in the end, these self-improvement measures that are propagated in these cortisol detoxes can also induce stress. And especially if you don't get it right, and if you do extra things to make you less stressed, it can unfortunately turn out that they make you more stressed. So I unfortunately do not have a solution. And I think that really part of this modern lifestyle, I mean, you can take yourself out of it and you can say, I'm not on social media and I don't have a smartphone, but then it is very hard to still be part of life. And I think especially for younger people, it's not, I mean, it sounds so simple, but to say leave social media if it stresses you, I think if this is where your social life happens, you cannot just do that. So I think we need to find ways to deal better with stress and to integrate as a society stress reducing measures, because I think many of the things that stress us, we have no control over. And then saying that if you just eat the right supplements and do the right kind of meditation practice, I am not convinced that this will help us overcome the stress. I think one thing that I for myself can say is that exercise really, really helps. So if one is stressed, just moving your body, and I think this goes back probably to this fight or flight response, if you already have this impulse to run or do or physically act, and then you just say, stay sitting at your desk. This is something that I can imagine. I don't have the proof, but I think anecdotally, and I think from what almost all people will tell you, integrating exercise can help reduce stress.
But to put some irony to it, who would use their common sense if there was a pill to cure it all?
Yeah.
We don't have it, obviously. And you mentioned all, I mean, it reaches from societal factors, psychology, obviously, even philosophy, faith, stuff like that, that play a role, have a say in what stresses us and what stress factors are in our lives, let alone healthy diet, moving, and so forth. But where do we stand in R&D when it comes to regulating stress through medication?
Yeah, I think that mostly the outcomes are being targeted. So for example, for anxiety or depression, the stress itself, there is not so much in what I could find in terms of medication happening. It's quite interesting because there was a survey in Germany and France. I think I saw it in a report on Arte. And they said that in France, 50, and in Germany, I think 60% of people would immediately take a pill that would make all the stress go away. But I think the problem, and that brings us back to the beginning, is we cannot live without the stress. We need the stress. The stress is very important for our lives. It's an important factor for motivation, for mobilizing energy, for functioning, for also really, like, as Huberman says it, for growth in a sense of also mental growth. I mean, we need to challenge ourselves, put ourselves in new situations in order to get to the next point in our lives. So there is no way around, I think, being stressed. So downregulating the whole stress system doesn't really work. And what we can also see is that, I mean, we have very good evidence what happens if you interfere with the cortisol system by increasing cortisol levels artificially, because there are many diseases, inflammatory bowel diseases, for example, other autoimmune diseases, again, cancer patients also often get external corticosteroids. And this can lead to a number of negative side effects. Initially, people feel better. And I mean, it's still better than having this constant inflammation that is very harmful, of course, for your health. But what will happen over time, and people generally develop mood and sleep disturbances, many of them become susceptible to infections, even severe infections like pneumonia in some cases. You gain weight, lose muscle, lose bone substance in many cases. So I think there is no easy way with such a complex and highly interconnected system to interfere in a simple fashion. And therefore, I think really having a stress pill that makes the bad stress go away, but keeps the eustress, the positive stress, I think this will be very difficult because both use exactly the same system. It's just the way that the system is, the time, pulsatility, and also the cognitive framing and the emotional framing of the system that makes a difference. And regulating that with a single pill sounds difficult. But if I would have to choose one, I would just bet on Ozempic because it seems to be good for anything. So maybe, I mean, we talked about like this interconnection between growth, between glucose system and inflammation already when we talk about longevity, when we talk about weight loss, diabetes drugs, Ozempic, etc. And it seems, I mean, cortisol also is an important regulator of that. So somehow these axes are definitely highly connected. We're still, I think, grasping a little bit in the dark of how they are connected. But I think that understanding more about how these metabolic syndromes are also linked to other bodily functions and to inflammation, and which again seems to be linked to cognition and even neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, I think getting a better understanding is something that in the next decades, we will understand, and especially the role of inflammation. And I think here we will also learn more about how to deal with cortisol.
To come to a closing, one A and B question, is there a full-blown cortisol conspiracy, as we called this episode? Would you say yes or no? And do we need this advertised detox when it comes to cortisol, all of us? Or would you say it's good to think about it, but you don't actually need this detox?
So for the conspiracy, I called it that because this is, I think, what the influencers make you believe, that somehow it was hidden from us, that all of our problems are traced back to cortisol. There is definitely no conspiracy around it. We know and have known for a long time that cortisol is an important hormone, but we also know it's only one of many hormones and cognitive functions and other bodily functions that regulate our being. It's very important because it can interact with a lot of different systems, but it's not the magic bullet to all our problems, especially since there is no simple way for us to regulate it, which the cortisol detox would make us believe, which again brings us back. I mean, cortisol detox usually involves the idea of eating very healthy, exercising very regularly, doing other things like taking supplements, doing fasting regimens, and all of that. It's all these biohacking theories, and some of them a little bit more or a little bit less. But in the end, we can try to be less stressed, and this will act as a cortisol detox. But if this regimen becomes really complicated and stressful, this will probably not really work. And I think the role of supplements, in my opinion, in general, is usually very questionable. If it would be so easy to just take the right substance and everything would be better, I think we would have recognized that already. And I'm not saying that it doesn't work for some people to take certain things and certain supplements, but I think many of them, I mean, they're not regulated, by FDA or by EMA. That makes it also a little bit dangerous, because for some of them, we don't really know what's going on, and they can also interfere. I would say in the best case, they have no function and they don't do anything. That would be nice. Then you have a placebo effect and you're fine. But in the worst case, they also do other things and have side effects. And that would be something that might not be beneficial. And this idea that many people say, but it's all natural, is of course complete BS, because it's like there are many poisonous mushrooms that are also completely natural, but natural doesn't mean healthy at all. So I think cortisol detox, it's a fancy name for trying to have a stress-reduced lifestyle, plus often accompanied by having something that you have to pay for, be it like a program or supplements. If this is something that helps you improve your lifestyle, maybe for some people it works, by all means do it. I think that, at least from my personal experience, I was a little bit like going along these ideas of biohacking a couple of years ago, and I found that it stressed me out much more, and that just trying to live a normal life can work better.
A highly individual affair. This should be a general closing of our show, Izzy. Mm-hmm. I also think it's fair, due to the fact that we publish this show at the end of the year, it's only fair to wish happy holidays and a good 2025 to all the listeners that we thank. And maybe, drink less, a little less alcohol.
And coffee.
And listen a lot and speak a little less. Maybe a hint for better understanding and less stress for the holidays, right?
And try to go for a walk on the holiday days.
Absolutely. Thank you, Izzy.
Thank you.
This was We're Doomed, We're Saved, episode number 29. Again, many thanks for listening to our show. Subscribe to us, give us hints, and let us know what you want us to talk about in the context of the biorevolution. And you'll find everything else on
sciencetales.com.